Hi, welcome back to Very Different Books. We're your host, Jared.
And Victoria.
This is the second episode. Thanks for coming back.
Yes, we appreciate the listens.
We appreciate the ratings. Don't forget to subscribe.
Right off the bat, you couldn't resist. But yeah, seriously, to everybody who's giving us ratings so far, we really appreciate it.
All four. I mean, the first episode was also pretty, like, I don't want to say slapped together, but it was definitely cut together.
Yeah. We had two different recordings that we kind of had to mix and match together to make it work. And it
was two recordings, six different books.
It was a lot.
It was a journey to get to that first episode, which was too quiet. Also, I would like to apologize for having such a quiet first episode. I understand that that creates problems.
We're not sound engineers, so we're still kind of learning how to make all of this sound optimal.
If you popped your drums, I'm very sorry.
We apologize sincerely. But yeah, so this time we decided not to fill each other in on the books that we were reading. But unfortunately for me, Jared guessed mine immediately on site.
Yeah.
So he's known since day one.
Pretty easy guess, in my opinion. I don't know if it's just like, it might be like physically I looked at the book and I was like, I know what book that is. Even though it had a different dust jacket on it and you had quite cleverly tried to hide what book it was.
That almost perfectly fitting other dust jacket for my collection.
But I saw the book and immediately knew what it was just from work. And also I feel like in a way it's obvious, you know,
just from knowing me.
It's like a, I don't want to say low hanging fruit, but it kind of was. I also have cleverly disguised my book. I don't think Victoria's figured it out. When we get to my portion of the podcast, I'll ask about it.
You'll ask about it.
Yeah, see if you can guess.
I could not. I have not even...
No clue?
No, I have not been thinking about it because I can't even remember most of the books on your bookshelf, let alone guess one that you might have just picked up from work or like... I could not guess anything that you ever read ever. Because you have such a wide variety of things that you draw from in terms of what you choose.
You have a pretty wide variety too, honestly. But I mean, for whatever reason, I knew that one.
I mean, it's a very sizable book.
It's large.
It is big. It took me ages and I hated it.
So. Do you want to jump right in then?
Sure. So, yeah, I decided to read Midnight Sun by Stephanie Meyer because I hate myself, apparently.
And so for people who don't know, what is that exactly?
It is basically a rewrite of the first book of the Twilight Saga.
Is it the first time she's rewritten it?
No. I wish you guys could have seen his face. He looked so gleeful as he said that. No, this is actually the second time she's rewritten it. The first one was for the... Was it the 10th anniversary? I think it was.
Better hold on tight, spider monkey.
You know, you say that and it just makes me want to watch the movie, unironically, because that scene is so ridiculous that
there
I might love have it.
Been, if I was going to watch the movie, there would definitely be a touch of irony.
Mm. I was actually watching like the Riff Tracks commentary when I was like getting ready to record because I was like, I just need to get some of that funny energy in here because there's a lot of this book that just made me like roll my eyes constantly that I kind of lost a lot of the humor that I normally get out of talking about Twilight because it's all so bonkers.
I mean, I feel like, you know, enjoying a bad movie is not the same as enjoying a bad book. A book requires a lot more from you than a movie does.
You can't like half tune out a book or like otherwise you just kind of lose track of what's happening and it's not the best. But yeah, so I guess a little a little history about me in the Twilight series. I started reading them almost as soon as they came out.
In 1981?
Are you calling me old?
I don't know why. I just felt like making a joke about it. It does feel like a long time ago.
Yeah, the first one came out in 2005. I don't know if I started reading it that year because one of my friends kind of turned me on to them at some point. But I did start reading them while I was in high school. And I even read the first leaked chapters of Midnight Sun when they were... unintentionally released in 2008. So that's how long this book has been in progress. The quick story on that is she had been working on Midnight Sun for probably, I don't know, a few months, maybe a year. And she had sent out different copies, slightly altered, to a whole bunch of different people. And someone leaked it online.
But she knew who it was.
Yes.
Because that's like so smart, actually.
It is really. It's very like whodunit kind of style.
Well, it's just clever to be like everyone has a slightly different version. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really smart.
Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, because it had been leaked, she decided not to release it because she couldn't trust anybody. She'd been betrayed, which I kind of understand.
I don't know anything about Stephanie Meyer, but she seems a little dramatic.
I mean, a little bit.
That said, I've never been betrayed, so.
I want to say that it was a friend of hers, which might have influenced that decision, perhaps.
Some big yikes.
Yeah, not the best. So Midnight Sun is a rewrite of the first book, but it's from Edward's perspective. Now, I guess before I get into anything, if you happen to not know anything about Twilight, bless you.
It seems unlikely. But...
It seems unlikely, but in case you don't, it's basically a Romeo and Juliet style love story between clumsy human Bella and perfect Edward the vampire.
I'm like, that's quite funny. It's Romeo and Juliet Shakespeare.
Yeah, they're all the Twilight
heavily
books are
praised, highly regarded Shakespeare.
Yeah, they're kind of loosely based on classic literature.
Are they?
Yes.
Hmm.
Which is
not the first, won't be the last.
Oh, I'm trying to remember what the other ones are based on, but I'm drawing a complete blank, so don't ask me currently. Maybe I can add it in the notes if anyone really wants to ask.
That's kind of an interesting thing. I often think about how, like, part of the reason I think I'm drawn to classics or quote unquote classics is because, you know, you kind of want to read the original and best or like the most original version of an idea. So,
yeah.
And I often say, like, you know, when you talk about a lot of classics, like maybe something like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's kind of everywhere, right?
Yes.
Especially, like, in cartoons and stuff. Like, they just recycle it over and over and over again.
Because it's good. But yeah, it's exactly. Also, like, it's been around forever, so everyone's done it. So
it's
it doesn't
compelling
really...
enough that it's, like, and it becomes ubiquitous.
I'll give you a quick spoiler warning, because this book did come out just last year. If you really know anything about the first book, you won't find a ton of surprises in here. Because it's basically the same book with just a couple of scenes swapped out. I'm going to talk about pretty much the entire plot here in kind of, like, jot form, so... And I'll go over the characters really quickly here. So we have Bella. I think she's supposed to be 17. She's kind of like in her last couple years of high school. And her main character traits are that she loves literature, so reads a lot.
Does she?
Yes.
I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah, she's a big reader. And she's very, very clumsy. Huge klutz. That plays in quite a few times over the course of the series. And she likes to blush a lot. She gets embarrassed really easily.
I understand.
But that's kind of the most that we get out of her character. Apparently, she's also kind of made out to be like a caretaker of her parents because her mom is very flighty and her dad just kind of focuses on his work. She kind of takes care of them a little bit. And then you've got the vampires. So Edward is the main one. He is, I think, 104, but he was turned into a vampire at 17. Now, they did specify in this book, and not so much in the other ones, that when someone's turned into a vampire, their maturity stops at that age. So they can accumulate knowledge and all that stuff as they age.
So it's like
age.
A retcon or whatever. She's like, no, it's not creepy, I swear.
It still kind of is, though.
Oh, 100%.
Because he sounds wicked pretentious, but then he also gets, like, insane teenage drama and jealousy, which is just... I did not enjoy that at all. Edward became a vampire when he was 17, dying of the Spanish flu, so he's 104 years old. As a vampire, he has superhuman strength, can move at speeds that make him nearly invisible to the human eye, and has his own individual talent. He's also telepathic, so he's very OP. He's also incredibly fast, even by vampire standards.
Hmm.
He and the rest of his family also only feed on animals rather than humans, because they feel like it's more humane and dignified, and kind of makes it easier for them to stay in one place if people don't constantly go missing around them. Edward and Bella first see each other in the cafeteria during lunch on Bella's first day at Forks High School, because she has just recently moved there to live with her dad. She's sitting with some new friends. Edward is sitting with his family. The kids start filling Bella in on the weird Cullen family because they are very odd in that they're all supposedly adopted kids in this family, but they're also all kind of paired off together. So they're dating each other.
Yeah,
a little bit weird.
That's definitely really weird. It's I don't think that's a thing.
No. They're not really technically related, but they live together and they're supposed to be teenagers. It's just very...
Is there anything normal in the book?
No. Bella starts asking about Edward specifically because, of course, he's very, very handsome. But also he's been staring at her because he realizes that he cannot hear her thoughts. He can hear everybody else's thoughts, but he cannot hear hers, which he finds very bizarre. So he's been looking at her, which
it's because she doesn't think.
Weird. That's a very clever joke that everybody has made.
I just thought of that. I thought I was special.
Sorry, love.
It's because she's a Buddhist monk and she learned how to turn off her thoughts.
He also otherwise notes that she is unremarkable at first glance, so doesn't find anything special about her aside from the fact that there is nothing going on in her head for whatever reason. Now, the greatest source of tension in the saga overall is that Bella's blood is supposed to be overwhelmingly intoxicating to Edward and other vampires, but specifically him. So in the original story, Bella goes into her biology class, and as she walks past this fan or air conditioner or whatever, her scent gets blown right in Edward's face, and he almost loses his shit. Because he's just like, oh my god, this is the best smelling thing I've ever smelled. So everyone is going to die.
It's time for a tasty human.
Yeah, basically. But he doesn't drink human blood, right? So he just kind of has this panic moment of just like, everyone is going to die. I'm going to kill all these kids, and I'm going to kill her because I have no choice, because it is just driving me insane immediately.
Hmm.
Like, there's actually several pages where he details how he's going to sweep from one side of the room to the next and snap all these kids' necks.
Oh my god.
Before anyone realizes anything, and then he's gonna attack her and there'll be no screaming because everyone's dead.
So nerdy.
It was creepy.
I had
as
a five stage plan to kill everybody on that bus.
Can you tell them what that's from in case
yes, I might have to actually put this one in the description.
Mm-hmm.
The video I'm referencing is this guy. It's called Cairo Sejuro Swordsman on YouTube, and I'll put a link in the description.
Please watch it. It's worth it.
It's very funny. It's about a guy who breaks up like a fight on a bus with his sword because he's a swordsman, and just the way he talks is very entertaining. I believe he has passed away.
Regrettably.
So, you know.
There is that. But the video
our condolences
still
to like his family. Yes. But the video is excellent, and I will link it.
Mm-hmm. So in this book, we do learn that Edward has like this immediately, like, everyone's going to die because I can't help myself.
Yeah,
but in the original
five-stage plan.
Yeah. In the original, Bella's just like, oh, he's looking at me like really weird. Like, he's glaring at me. He looks like he hates me on sight. Like, this is just bizarre. But now we know that Edward's just like prepared to just murder everybody immediately.
I wonder if I could clip in from that video.
You could probably try.
I think I might because I definitely misquoted it. I don't think he actually says that, but he says something kind of
it's
like
it's pretty
it.
Close.
Tell you what, I'll cut it in right now.
The sad truth is that they weren't even a challenge. I already had a full five-stage plan ready to take everyone out and anybody else who got involved, just in case. That's just the way I do things.
So it even goes into detail. It's like, well, even if I don't kill all these kids, like, if I can make it until after class, I'll find a way to lure her out into the woods so that no one will notice that she's gone.
Yeah, that's really
like
charming.
He's trying to kind of make it work, but also trying to talk himself out of it, because then if anyone realizes that it's that she went off with him, if anyone sees them together, and then she never comes home, obviously, it's going to cause problems for his family. We also learned that at this point, it's been 2 weeks since the family has been hunting, so Edward's just really fucking thirsty, and he's just like, this girl's going to die.
Okay, then. Very creepy.
It's
especially
very creepy
when you say it like that.
Yeah. Like I said, there's a lot of detail, but he does manage to kind of restrain himself and talk himself down and go like, I can't cause this trouble for my family. I don't want to be this person. So as soon as class is over, he runs over to the administration office and tries to transfer out of that class. Unfortunately, there is no open other class that he can transfer into. And of course, Bella happens to walk into the office as he's trying to transfer out. And she goes, oh, so he really hates me that much that he has to get out of my class. And one of the other things that's really creepy about this book is because Edward is telepathic, he can hear everything that everyone's thinking, including the friggin' office administrator, who is probably a middle-aged woman who keeps reminding herself that he is too young for her.
Oh.
Which is just like, could you not?
It's just the pains of being hot at face value.
So gross. I hated it so much. Anyway, after school, he manages to get back to his family, and they have this big discussion about, like, this happened to me. I almost killed someone without really a whole lot of thought going into it. I have to leave. So he winds up going to stay in Alaska with a whole other clan of vampires that live similarly to him, and he's trying to get his life together, trying to kind of like draw back on being that dignified person that he's been for decades. Eventually figures like, I can do this, I can manage. So he goes back home, and then he tries to be friends with her, but he's really awkward about it because he's like, I really shouldn't be friends with you, I'm really dangerous for you, but I kind of can't stay away from you, so I'm just not gonna. And she's like, you're fucking weird, dude. Like, it's just really bizarre. And I'm kind of skipping over a lot because it doesn't really matter, especially if you've already read the books or kind of know the gist. So we get to the what is called the pivotal van scene, or the accident scene, by people who are fans of the books. Bella is in the school parking lot. It is very icy out. She's standing next to her truck. Edward, she notices, is across the parking lot. He's nowhere near her. This dude, Tyler, comes zipping into the parking lot in his van.
Oh, fucking Tyler.
Fucking Tyler. And he loses traction on the ice and starts spinning out, and his van is headed right towards Bella and her truck. And she just kind of freezes and goes like, I'm gonna die. But then suddenly, Edward is there next to her. He grabs her, kind of like drops her down towards the ground so she's not gonna get hurt in any meaningful way. But then is also able to stop the van from coming any closer by just holding his hand out. So he just like completely stops everything from happening.
Like, this is a very famous scene that you're describing right now.
It is a very, very famous scene.
Yeah, so they know.
They know. But now we have it from Edward's perspective, where he's trying to consider that if I help her, I risk, you know, being exposed because I obviously wasn't anywhere near her.
Yeah, he's going to like reveal the Illuminati to the normies or whatever.
Basically. But the other side of it was, if I let her get killed or if I let her get hurt, her blood is going to be everywhere and I cannot contain myself. So I'll be risking even further exposure because I'll obviously just like drive myself crazy and probably go and feed on her when she's already like, you know. Naturally, she survives and she knows that something is up at this point. And she's like, you're not human because you literally stopped that van from squishing me into nothing. So what is the deal? And he basically tries to gaslight her and say like, oh, you didn't, like, I was standing next to you the whole time. We don't know what you're talking about. And she goes, no, I know what I saw. I saw you across the lot. And he goes, well, no one's going to believe you.
Yeah, that's weird. Why are you supposed to like this person if he's like so shitty?
And like, I understand that he's trying to protect his family and like not have to uproot them or put them through any more kind of like effort to conceal themselves than they already have. But it's still just like, don't do that. It's bad. So this also results in Edward having to have more conversations with his family about what they're going to do about Bella, because she obviously knows that something's up. In this conversation with his family, his sister Alice, her special talent is essentially being able to see possible futures. She looks out for the family in all sorts of respects, so if anything's going to go wrong, she's going to know about it and warn them so that they can do something else to kind of like make sure it doesn't happen. So she sees a whole bunch of different shit. She's just like, Bella's going to be one of us one day. And even if that doesn't happen, like, she's going to be best friends with me and you guys are going to fall in love and it's going to be great as long as you don't freaking kill her. And he goes, oh, well, that's great. That's really great. I don't want any of that at all. And Alice is just like, I want to be her bestie. You don't kill her. You do not kill this kid.
That's funny. She's like, I see best friend future. Yeah.
Alice is a really fun character. I really enjoy her.
That's good.
Yeah.
Alice the Redeemer.
The Redeemer. Everybody loves Alice. I don't know anybody who does.
Go ask Alice. She'll tell you some lies.
She will know everything, including the Powerball numbers. So what bothered me about this is that it kind of preloads the idea in Edward's head that he's going to fall in love with Bella. So instead of having this organic story where it's like he's trying to humanize this person so that he feels less driven to kill her, he kind of watches her now with this whole thing of like, could I love her? Do I love her? Is it happening yet? Like, if there's literally a quote that says, did I love her? I did not think so. Not yet. Alice's glimpses of that future had stayed with me, though, and I could see how easy it would be to fall into loving Bella. So, thanks, Alice. I guess you kind of helped. But I feel like it would have been a lot more interesting if he had tried to humanize her in his own way instead of going like, oh, well, she's going to be like my girlfriend or my mate one day. Or like, even if you had tried to like purposefully antagonize her, but then you kind of come to love her because you know more about her because you hate... I don't know. There was other ways to do this.
It is kind of weird that Sonny would be like, yeah, you're going to love this person.
Yeah.
And you're just like, all right. All right, I guess I will.
I guess if you had someone in your family who knew that and was telling you that, it would be kind of hard to shake that knowledge.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's kind of hard to compare with real life.
Yeah.
Where, like, that's not a thing. But
no, not at all. Anyway, I wish that had been the book. As bed... Bedward.
As bedmass.
After this conversation with Alice where he's being told that he'll either kill her or fall in love with her, Edward starts making note of things that Bella does that aren't mentioned in any way in the original story. So it's like being kind to people who are having a bad day, sticking up for someone who's being teased.
Oh my god, that's so fucking
giving,
gross.
Like giving them an out in like uncomfortable situations kind of a thing. And I'm...
Oh, people really liked my books. I better just like make my character the best character ever that it's been 20 years later.
And I have written in my notes here that I said, I'm convinced that this is not only a lazy way to make Bella seem like a wonderful potential girlfriend and snack, but as Meyer's way of saying, hey, look, Bella's not so one-dimensional as everyone thought. She's got range.
I'm not fooled.
No.
I mean, I've never read the book.
It was very... I don't know. In my mind, it's very transparently trying to flesh Bella out as a character, because that was such a big criticism of the series, that Bella doesn't really have a personality or doesn't really have a whole lot of depth to her. Theoretically, so you could, you know, be like a self-insert character and be like, oh, well, I'm Bella in this story.
Yeah.
Which is like...
Is that intentional?
I don't know.
Like, did she write? Well, I guess if you don't know, you don't know.
Yeah. I can't speak to that. That's just kind of like a running accepted theory, essentially. But yeah, like another part, he says, through all these little things, I was able to add the most important quality to my list, the most revealing of them all, as simple as it was rare. Bella was good. All the other things added up to that whole. Kind and self-effacing and unselfish and brave, she was good through and through, and no one seemed aware of that besides me. Like, really? No one else, aside from like maybe the people she's doing these nice things for?
Even her dad?
Like... Even her dad! It's like, okay, Everything about this is just like, I don't know. It's so weird. Edward's also like a bit of a shit to his other sister, Rosalie, because Rosalie is making comments about why would anyone ever find Bella attractive? She's so plain. And he goes, well, why would anyone think she's plain? She's so obviously beautiful. And I'm just like, Edward, you literally called her unremarkable the first time you saw her. What is your deal?
He's blinded.
Very, very much blinded by rose colored glasses. And he literally starts stalking her.
Oh, that's great.
Like, really, really quickly.
Good stuff. You should not do that.
Don't do that. He gets into this really weird, almost anxious thing of, like, I have to protect her from herself or from me. Like, there's a whole thing of, I'm obviously very dangerous for her. I shouldn't be anywhere near her. But I also want her to live because I'm supposed to be falling in love with her. So what if something happens to her? I have to always be there. So he watches her from, like, the woods outside her house. He sneaks into her room at night several times.
I feel like this is a very problematic book.
Yeah. Yeah. I often wonder what I was thinking when I was super into them when I was a teenager. Because looking back, I'm just like, this is all terrible. Never do this. What's worse, though, is that when he starts, like, telling Bella all the stuff that he's been doing, she has no problem with it, which is... also not good. Kids, if you ever have a boy sneaking into your room at night, run. Or, you know, call the cops. Or if your dad's a cop like Bella's is, just call him. It's fine.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I don't know. I don't know why it was so popular for, like, I guess mostly young women.
Yeah. Well, I remember the draw for the friend that kind of got me into them was there was a scene where, what was it? Bella had, Edward had taken her home. I think she had fainted or something because they were doing blood typing in their biology class. And she doesn't like blood because irony. So he drives her home. And then she goes, well, my truck is at the school, so I won't be able to get to school tomorrow. And he's like, well, I'll get your truck. Don't worry about it. So he manages to get her truck home. And he leaves a note in her truck that says, be safe. And I remember my friend going nuts, going just like, oh, he wants her to be safe. That's so nice and that's so precious. But then in this book, we realize that like he has weird. It's kind of weird. He also has to, like, there was something about breaking into her house to, like, find the keys to go get the truck. It was all very weird because I'm like, why would she not have the keys at school? I don't know. It was a whole thing. But there was a lot of, everybody seemed really into the fact that he was so immediately into her and wanted her to be safe. But that's also because we weren't really thinking about, he's always around. He's not really, like... giving her space and she doesn't know that he's always there.
Is it just because it's like a simple story?
Yeah.
Is that what attracts young people to it?
And they're probably not thinking critically, right? They're just like, oh, this perfect guy is so into me. That's amazing. Whereas you're like, but he's a fucking creep.
Yeah. I don't know. It's weird.
It is very weird. Edward is also very aware that everything that he's doing is wrong. Like,
oh,
very,
yeah, he's 100.
he's 104. But he also immediately justifies everything that he's doing in the name of protecting Bella, which is... kind of garbage.
Yeah.
Like there's even a point, like I think it was right after the van accident where he starts kind of like following her around a lot, where he says, I had a yearning to ditch class 2 in order to find the girl again, like a stalker, an obsessed stalker, an obsessed vampire stalker. That is a direct quote.
I like how it says the girl.
The girl. Because he doesn't actually care about her yet. He's just
weird.
Obsessed.
The girl.
It's very strange. Then we get to the Port Angeles scene. So Bella and a couple of her friends have gone to Port Angeles, which is in Washington. They all live in Washington, but I hadn't heard of the city before this book. So Washington. They are going there to buy prom dresses. And Edward is just like, well, she's going to like a slightly bigger place than where we live in the small town. So I'm going to go follow her.
Okay, because like he's nuts.
Because he's nuts.
Because he's Richard Ramirez.
Oh, God. And Bella decides that she's going to go check out this bookstore because she wants to find books, like reference material about different kinds of creatures that might live in Washington.
Hey, man, you don't need a reason to go to a bookstore. That's all I'm saying, right?
High five. Yeah, but he kind of stops listening to them after a certain point because he's obviously not like right there watching him. He's listening to thoughts as they're all kind of walking around. But it takes him a while because he can't hear Bella's thoughts to realize that she's not with the group anymore. She's gone off on her own to this bookstore.
Oh, no.
So he panics a little bit and has to basically hunt her down and goes to this shop, but she's already gone. So he's following her scent around trying to find out where she is. And she has wandered into some other area that she's not familiar with. And there's these four or five guys who have decided that, hey, we're going to take this girl. They're going to do something really untoward to her.
Okay.
But, I mean, in the original book, like, obviously that's scary enough. Because, like, if you're a teenage girl and there's suddenly a whole bunch of grown-ass men following you around in a dark street, stuff's not going to be good for you.
Yeah, that's creepy, probably. For sure.
But now we get Edward's perspective and he can see what they're thinking, which drives him into a rage because... that's my almost girlfriend that you're thinking about doing so bad weird. Things to. Okay. So he...
as opposed to like, this is a horrible this thing is a really you're going to do. I'm going to stop you from doing this just because I know it's a bad thing.
Yeah. So he swoops in and saves the day and takes Bella to supper and she kind of gets him to spill the beans on everything because she's like, I know that there's something else.
Is this about the part you. Where he's like, say it?
That scene is basically just in the movie. But,
okay. Yeah, whatever.
But... yeah, in this dinner kind of situation, she basically gets all this information out of him about, like, what can you do? What are you? And it's kind of just like an info dump, essentially. But after this, which was not in the original book, Edward's like, we got to do something about this guy who almost did something terrible to Bella. And I kind of misread it because I was kind of skimming because I was kind of going, this is all ridiculous. I know, like, this scene. I
don't even want to read this.
I don't want to read this. And so he goes back to his house. He's talking to Carlisle, who is a doctor. So he obviously got, like, he's got a medical bag. And he says, hey, Carlisle, can you go take care of this guy for me? Because if I go and deal with him, I'm going to kill him. Carlisle goes like, yeah, sure. So he talks about getting a sedative out of his bag. And my brain goes, are they going to, like, euthanize the guy? Like, what is that? That's dark. That's different.
You're like, yeah, kill him.
Kill him. But then it turns out that they just kind of sedate him and take him to Portland and be like, hey, here's this, like, serial killer you guys have been looking for. That's how they deal with it. They're just hey, cops, you guys have wanted this guy in a couple different states. Here he is. And I was like, I kind of would have rather you actually just killed him because still, just for flavor or something.
I don't know, man. That's crazy. That's like a super problematic thing.
It was all very weird. But it would have been interesting. I guess. I don't know.
What compelled you to keep reading the book if you weren't enjoying it?
Because
I drop books all the time.
That's true. I kind of felt like I owed it to myself because I've been waiting for this book on some level to come out for like 12 years. Because I remembered reading those leaked chapters in 2008. And then when it finally did come out, I was just like, oh my God, it's real. I kind of wanted to know, like, there's the whole fill in the blanks thing of, like, what was Edward's side of this whole thing when he was separated during these key scenes or whatever. And I was curious about why or how she was going to handle it and if she was going to try and make things less creepy or more creepy. And she really leaned into the more creepy option, which I did not appreciate. Man,
people are saying my character, who's supposed to be really great and attractive, is creepy. And I better just double down on it.
Yeah, really. We do also find out in this scene that Edward hasn't always been the goody two-shoes, I'm only gonna eat deer kind of vampire. Like, he had this kind of rebellious stage where he went and he wanted to feed on humans because that's what you're supposed to do. But he figured, well, if I have to kill people, I may as well kill bad people. So he essentially had a vigilante kind of stage where he would listen around for criminals. And then as soon as they did something bad, he'd be like, oink, your blood is mine now. Yeah, essentially. But yeah, he doesn't really want to do that anymore because he's still taking lives rather than just like letting the justice also, system punish people.
Also, it's like a reverse Interview with a Vampire or whatever.
I'm not really familiar with Interview with a Vampire.
I think I've seen that movie or like chunks of it. And I'm pretty sure he's like, I don't want to kill people. So he's like eating rats or something.
Oh.
Or like sucking rat blood.
I do want to read at least one Anne Rice novel because the only thing I really know about Anne Rice is that she really hates fanfic.
I guess that doesn't make her a bad person necessarily.
No, but
she's just like really greedy or something.
She's very litigious, and that's literally all that I know about her. So,
as a rule, people who are super litigious aren't usually the best people, no. I find.
Like, let people enjoy your books. It's not like they're trying to make a profit off of it. I don't know. Let people do their creative writing.
That's stupid. I mean, I've never read an Anne Rice book. I'm never going to read an Anne Rice book. I don't know anything about it. I just assume it's garbage.
There is also apparently a thing where after she had published a few books, she got so sure of herself that she's like, I don't need people to edit my books. And so after she
that's just not true.
Yeah, apparently. And again, I haven't read them. This is all like secondhand info that I've gotten from like Tumblr or somewhere. So it might not actually be true. But allegedly, she got the publisher to agree to not really edit her books anymore. And they allegedly became really trash immediately because it's like almost like editors actually have a job for a reason.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that you shouldn't like do just by yourself, especially sometimes creative things.
Input is good.
Feedback is good.
Oh, right. So during this whole dinner where she's kind of getting all this info, he's still waiting for her to have that moment of just like, holy shit, this is actually really, really bad for me. I need to run. Like, I need to get away from this guy. He's obviously dangerous. But when she doesn't do that, he has this thought that like made my jaw drop because it was so ridiculous.
There was a bunch of times when you were reading this book where I was like, ooh, I can't wait to hear about that.
So I'm going to quote here. It said, I started to wonder if she was entirely stable. I supposed that I could arrange for her to receive the best care available. Carlisle would have connections to find her the most skilled doctors, the most talented therapists. Perhaps something could be done to fix whatever was wrong with her. Whatever it was that made her content to sit beside a vampire with her heart beating calmly and steadily, I would watch over the facility naturally and visit as often as she allowed.
So stupid.
It's like, yeah, you can't just have her committed.
Wow.
What the fuck?
I also like how it's like, oh, you like me? Something's wrong with you. Like, is the part of the movie where he's like,
God,
I'm a vampire. Vampires are supposed to be attractive to humans or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that in this book too?
Yes.
Is that canon?
Yes.
So basically he's like, I'm supposed to be attractive. And then he's like, yo, why are you attracted to me,
also,
man?
Why can't you stay away from me?
It's just weird. Like,
dude.
I don't think you're stable.
Yeah. How dare you not think that any of this is creepy when it's like you're a super hot guy who just saved her from like imminent disaster. And you're obviously fascinated with her, even though there's really nothing special about her. So why wouldn't she be like, yeah, let's find out more about this, please. I don't know. It's all.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
dumb.
If you found out vampires were real, I'm pretty sure you wouldn't run. Wouldn't you be kind of interested? You're like, oh shit, yeah. This is really interesting.
I mean, there would be something if he was like, yeah, I have been thinking about killing you since the minute I met you. I'd
is
be
that
like,
what he says?
Pretty close. Pretty close.
Maybe she is a little unstable. I don't know.
I mean, to quote Robert Pattinson in one of the interviews he did when he was making the first movie, he's like, there's very definitely something wrong with her, and most definitely something wrong with him. I love Robert Pattinson. He's great.
Good old Ro-Pat.
Okay, so to kind of test how she's doing with all this vampire knowledge that she has now, we're going to get into the whole sparkly vampire thing here.
Oh my
god,
it's already been an hour.
I know it's been an hour.
Okay.
I'm trying.
It's all good.
It's so much. Basically shows her that like the reason the vampires aren't supposed to come out in the sunlight is because their skin sparkles, which is dumb.
Yeah, whatever. I don't know. There's nothing we can say about that hasn't already been said.
It's been out there since 2005. The weird thing, though, is that Edward's always had this thing of like, well, don't look at me. I'm obviously so grotesque and you can never love me. I'm just like, dude, you have like glitter on you. Does that suddenly make you less attractive?
This is also the person who's like, you're going to be inherently attracted to me because I'm a vampire.
Yeah.
And also vampire powers.
So just imagine some diamond dust on my skin and suddenly that takes all of that away. But anyway, they kind of have their first romantic moment here. And he's having to work on like self-restraint and be like, I am so strong that I could like really easily kill you without even meaning to. But they manage to navigate that and everything's fine. He gets really kind of like blamey when like he kisses her and she kisses him back. And then suddenly he starts to lose control and it's all her fault because she was doing the same thing that he was doing. I don't know. It's all
That's kind of gross.
It's very weird.
Incel vibes.
Right? Okay. And we're going to fast forward to the baseball scene. Which, yeah, again, anybody who knows anything about Twilight knows that vampires fucking love baseball.
Everybody loves baseball. That's like one of the funnest sports out of all of them.
Take some pajamas and go hit a ball with a stick and then run.
Pajamas.
Have you looked at their uniforms? They're pajama pants.
Are they? I don't know if I've ever really thought about it.
I did not come up with that thought. I got that from somebody else, but it's freaking true. So vampires can only play baseball when it's stormy because they make a lot of noise and the thunder covers it. So there's like, hey, there's a storm. Bella knows about our family. Let's all go play baseball and we'll bring her with us.
They make a lot of noise.
Well, because you
like hitting the baseball. Yeah. What, it sounds like thunder?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it sound more like a gunshot or something? Know. Like,
I didn't write it.
Oh man, you hear those gunshots the other day? No, it was just a thunderstorm.
I didn't write it. I didn't do it.
I'm just reading like a Thunderstorm, and it's like, brat-ta-ta, like.
So yeah, it's basically like a way to get Bella like kind of acquainted with the family and what they're really capable of. And I have written here, all is going fairly well in that there are literally 5 pages of pure baseball commentary that I'm sure no one asked for, Stephanie. Because who really cares about who's running at what base and who, like, I don't know. It's not necessary and it was very boring. 5 pages of a large book. But then there's these 3 other vampires who just kind of happen to show up because they hear this game going on. They're just like, we want to fucking play.
Because all vampires love baseball. Yeah. Is that really why? Or is it just because they heard the noise? Or
well,
is it like,
they heard,
get my baseball on.
It's like they heard this noise and they're just like, oh, hey, there's other ones in the area. And like maybe, you know, they're obviously doing something. So let's go and see who they are and we'll talk or whatever. One thing that was always kind of an issue with the first book is that these vampires show up and they don't immediately notice that Bella is there. Or like they notice that she's there, but not that she's human. And in this book, they explain why. So one of the other Cullens, his ability is to kind of affect the emotions of people who are in his immediate vicinity. But she kind of expands on that in that he has essentially made a whole bunch of the vampires who were in his family kind of seem like very mundane in that moment. Like he basically makes them gloss right over them. You're going to ignore this person and this person and this person. And you're going to focus on these 2 big vampires that we got in the very front because they're huge and scary. Only look at these 2 and not these other little ones in the back. Don't look at them.
Who's the scary vampires?
Well, Edward at the moment because he's all freaked out because he's just like, shit, they're going to eat her.
So he becomes a giant vampire.
He just looks scary because he's mad.
Physically changes.
Well, I guess not really physically changes. He just looks pissed.
It's like in Skyrim and you become a werewolf. Is that what it's like? Or you become like a vampire lord and you float around. Whoa.
I forgot there were vampires in Skyrim. But then there's also Emmett, who is literally just a jock, a big old vampire jock who is huge and loves fighting with people. So they're just like, yeah, look at him. He's big and he'll beat you. But anyway, eventually they kind of figure out, I think the wind shifts or something. They're just like, someone smells friggin' good. And they look at Bella and everyone's just like, shit, and they go to defend her, and that sets this one vampire guy off to be like, I'm gonna get you now. There's something good about you. If all these fucking vampires are defending you, I'm gonna get you. And apparently he's like this tracker who's like, that's his big thing. He's a hunter. If there's some quarry that he can't have for whatever reason, he's gonna make sure he gets it just for the fun of it.
Oh, that's so creepy.
It is very creepy. So they all kind of go back to the Cullen home base and they all split off into groups to be like, we're going to pretend we're taking Bella here and you're going to pretend we're taking Bella here. And she's actually going to go down to Arizona where her mom lives because it's sunny there and vampires don't want to go there because obvious reasons. But now they also figure that Edward and Bella have to split up here because obviously he's going to think that Edward's going to go with Bella because he was the most protective of her. When really he's going to try and lure him up to Calgary, apparently, or Banff.
Oh, wow.
And he's going to be like, yeah, we're going to draw him all the way up here. And they'll get us about 600 miles of running room. And when he figures out that it's a trap, we're going to chase him. We're just going to catch him.
Wouldn't it be easier to just, like, kill him?
He's very sneaky.
Well, like, when they're in the baseball field.
Oh, well,
they all... And, like, Edward can read people's thoughts and shit. So why wasn't he just like, okay, time to die?
I think there was something about Alice seeing that it wasn't going to go very well. Like, there would be a lot of casualties for some reason.
Oh, good plot hole.
Alice is always great for just plugging up good plot
hole. That's a good one. She's like... Oh, no, not
like,
right
not,
now.
Not this one. We gotta wait till later.
Wait till later.
Listen to Alice. So anyway, they don't catch him. And so they wind up going back to the town of Forks.
But isn't that like a real place?
It is a real place. And it became super popular for a bit. And I bet all the locals really
sure
love
that.
So they try and regroup. And while Edward is kind of like licking his wounds of I didn't get to kill this guy, Bella has been contacted in this hotel room that she and Alice and Jasper are camped out in Phoenix. And he says, I have your mom. You got to find a way to sneak away from your vampire friends and you're going to meet me at this address.
Does he have her mom?
No.
I was like, how would he even find that out?
I don't know, honestly.
Through his bitchy, witchy ways.
He's very cunning and wily, I guess. But I think he'd found her house somehow. Okay. And he had stolen a whole bunch of like home videos. And he had played clips of the videos over the phone so that he had the mom's voice. And Bella could hear him crying or whatever.
Why would you have a home video of that?
Or yelling for Bella because she was running down the street or something. Like, okay. Something.
All right. It's all good.
So Bella's just like, shit, I gotta get my mom. So she actually has this really good plan of sneaking away from them while they're in the airport, when they're going to go meet the other vampires at the airport. She has this really sneaky mission that's actually kind of impressive, but we don't get to see that this time. So instead we get a freaking car chase, which is the dumbest shit I have ever heard, because it's Edward driving and Alice sitting in the back, and she's using her visions to see, like, okay, there's the, yep, we're gonna, if we go at this exact speed, we go through all these little zippy sections and the gaps between cars, if we can get to that place and there'll be no accidents. And he can see what she's seeing through her head. So he's,
okay, it's too much.
I was mad, guys. I was so mad.
I'm like, fuck off.
They steal this really souped up, like, street racing car, which someone left at the airport, because God forbid they leave their expensive car at home and take a cab or an Uber. Which I guess wasn't a thing back then.
Ubers don't drive fast.
But anyway, they steal this racing car and they use her visions to make use of every spot in traffic along the freeway between there and this place that they have to get to. I think they also have to, like, run some lady off the road so they can ditch the streetcar. And they steal her van or something, and they use, like, a sedative to knock her out, and they cause other accidents to throw cops off the trail to go over here. And it's a whole thing. I hated it.
Also, it's like, if you're trying to get somewhere fast, why would you take a van instead of, like, your street racing car? All right.
I kind of started skimming at that point because it was all very stupid. I thought it was dumb. Maybe someone else would enjoy it, but I... Okay, so we're kind of wrapping up to the final scene here. So he has lured Bella to this ballet studio that was near her house. She's found out that Mom is not there. She's still safe in Florida on vacation or whatever the hell she's been doing. And this vampire is toying with her, and he's been filming it so that after Bella's dead, Edward would find the tape and he would be all pissed off. So he would go hunt this vampire and it would be a whole big game between the two of them. But the family gets there right quick. And they're just like, hey, dude, we're going to kill you now.
Okay.
But before they really
and Alice says it's going to work this time.
Alice says we win. But just as they kind of break the door in, he's essentially like, he was going to bite her and start turning her. And he kind of manages to make that happen just like the last little second there. So half the family is tearing this guy apart, which is great.
Great.
But Edward and Carlisle and Alice are just like, Bella, you've got like broken ribs and he stomped in your leg, so he broke that. And you've got glass all over the place and there's something wrong with your head. And she's going, yeah, my hand though. And they're like, yeah, he bit her. And so she's screaming because she's feeling... Also, like, vampires have venom. That's kind of how they explain how they turn people in. It's venom, I guess. All right, I don't know.
Creepy.
So she's feeling that and she's going, like, my hand's on fire and all this kind of stuff. And Carlisle's like, I can't handle doing all of this other medical shit and dealing with the venom. So, Edward, that's on you. You suck that venom back out. And he's just like, what? I can't. I will kill her. I can't do that. I've been trying so hard. I've been trying to be good. I cannot drink her blood. I cannot make that happen. And they're just like, you gotta. No one else is going to do it. It's got to be you. And this kind of, like, there's so much angsty stuff that happens for, like, a full page where it's like, I can't do this. I can't do this. I'll kill her. I can't do this. It's just like, shut up. We already know that you did it because there's a whole other book series that has to happen already and has happened. So just make it happen. And he does.
All right.
Obviously. And then she's in the hospital because, of course... And this part, I think, pissed me off more than anything else, where she has been begging him not to leave her because this whole time he's been like, I'm really bad for you. I'm obviously dangerous. You're hurt because of me. And I can't let this happen anymore. So I'm going to leave. And she's like, no, you cannot leave me here because, like, there's so much crazy stuff that's happened. I can't not know that vampires are a thing anymore. And also, what if this other vampire's friends come back for me? Like, you can't leave me by myself. And he goes, all right, fine. I'm not going to leave you. It'll be fine.
It's weird.
But then he's already planning. Now we know in his head he's planning to leave. As soon as she's better, he's going to fucking bounce.
Why?
Because he's bad for her.
Okay, then.
Because emo vibes. Which made me really mad because in the second book, he famously abandons her. And she just goes, like, catatonic depressive for, like, 3 full months. And he also knows this because Alice said if you ever leave her after, like, anything happens between you two, she'll never recover from it. Like, emotionally, she just never will. She has a vision, she shows it to him, so he knows it's gonna happen, and he goes, I don't care. I'm just gonna leave. And that's just how it goes. And I was just like,
wow.
Unacceptable.
Is that how the book ends?
Basically.
Wow.
Like, there's a scene after that where they're at prom, which is just kind of like a wrap-up thing.
In my mind, I'm like, does Twilight have themes?
I don't look for them. I don't bother.
I don't know if that's even a thing for Twilight. It's just kind of a story, right?
I don't know.
Right?
I like how you were asking me if my book has themes and I blanked and just went, don't date creepy men.
Ooh.
That's all I could get.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. There's a whole thing where they go to prom and Bella was like, she hadn't really considered that they were going to prom. She'd kind of forgotten about it because fucking vampire attack and whatever. And she's like, I thought we were getting all dressed up and fancy because you finally decided to make me into a vampire. And Edward's just like, what?
Why do you need to be fancy for that to happen?
That's exactly what he said. She goes, I don't know. It's just, I figured it might be a special occasion.
So she wants to be a vampire too.
Yes. Because she's like, I'm already like obviously in love with you. I know all the stuff about your family now. I want to be with you forever.
I want to be cool.
Yeah. And he's just like, no.
Vamp me. That's the other thing too. If he really was able to, if he was immortal and he didn't like Bella, he would never turn her into a vampire.
Mm-mm.
And instead he would just wait until she died.
Mm-hmm.
Or kill her, I guess. But I mean, if you're going to live forever, it doesn't matter. And the difference between 100 years and 1 year is like nothing to you because you live forever, right?
So pretty much.
I mean, he's only been alive for 100 years, but you think he would figure that out?
Yeah, but he's only 17, though. His brain might not have made that connection for some reason. I don't know.
All right,
it's
whatever.
It's all very dumb. So I had this whole section of, like, the things I liked versus the things I didn't like. And there's not very many things that I actually did like. I did like that they talked about Jasper's abilities more. They actually made him more useful, which was great because he's kind of an anomaly.
There's someone named Jasper in my book, too.
Is there? Oh, my first clue. Which does not help me at all. Doesn't help me at all. They also kind of hint that Bella's dad also has very like muffled thoughts or something. So Edward also can't get a lot off of him. So it's kind of hinted that it's a genetic thing, which is kind of weird. But I was like, that's all right. I'll take that. But yeah, there's also just, I'm not going to get into all of it because I've been talking for so long already now.
Yeah, this book sounds exasperating.
It was exhausting. It took me forever. And I never want to see it again. But yeah, there's just, Edward is just so creepy. And like the entire time he is very dramatic about like, I shouldn't be around her. I'm going to like, I'll kill her one day. It'll be super terrible. And I don't know how I would live with myself. And I couldn't, it's just not good. Oh, also, I'm convinced that at one point Stephanie Meyer was reading Twilight fan fiction because she started calling Jasper Jazz as a nickname.
Okay.
Or the other Collins would call him that. And that was a huge thing in fanfic. That never
That's
happened.
Kind of interesting.
That never happened in the original series ever.
Weird.
Everything is bad. I didn't care for it one bit. I wish that I had read the original book instead. Thanks for listening to my rant about that.
What made you decide to read Midnight Sun? I almost said Midnight Rising. I don't think that's a real book.
No. Is it weird if I say I just wanted closure? I mean, it was mostly curiosity, and because it had just come out, and also I actually managed to get my copy at work because someone finally donated a copy. And I was like, great, I don't have to spend 30 whatever bucks on this when I can spend four.
Right.
And so now I have this book in my hands and I can finish it after 12 years of waiting and I have regrets.
All right. Any closing thoughts on that one?
Oh, I will end with one thing that's in my my dislike list. That says, Edward does this thing that Bella calls dazzling, where it's essentially like, you know how vampires usually have like a sort of thrall that they can put people under?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. He kind of does that where it's like he just kind of looks at you a certain way, like talks really low or like kind of like that to kind of like make you more agreeable to things. He'll start, he starts doing that to Bella whenever she starts kind of putting up a fuss about something that she doesn't want to do. And it immediately makes her more agreeable to whatever he's trying to suggest. And I'm just like, run, run, kiddo.
Get
run.
Out of there, girl.
It's like he's trying to tell you over and over that he's not good for you. And he's right. He's not good for you.
Yeah, I feel like that is a pretty serious red flag in real life. If somebody's like, don't get close to me. All I do is hurt people. Mm-hmm. That's probably true.
Yep. So for anybody who's wondering why she chose a busted up pomegranate for the cover of Midnight Sun, it's because she was trying to use this whole parallel of Persephone and the pomegranate going down into hell, which is apparently where Edward hangs out. So every time, well,
what?
Yeah, metaphorically. Okay, so it's like every time she agrees to do something with him, it's essentially, oh, she's eating one more pomegranate seed and she's getting one step closer to being stuck in hell forever with me.
Is that how Persephone goes?
Basically.
She gets tricked into,
I think it was,
you're gonna eat pomegranate seeds off the ground?
I don't know if it was off the ground.
Wait, are you talking about E.T.? Little Reese's Pieces or whatever?
I'm not 100% on the lore.
Edward,
there.
Phone home.
EC phone home. Almost works.
Pretty good.
Yeah, that's, yeah, because the cover doesn't look great, I gotta say. I wasn't a huge fan of
it. Looked very Twilight to me.
It did. It also kind of looks like it's supposed to be looking like a heart in a way, like an actual anatomical heart. Anyway.
Love a pomegranate. Tasty, tasty fruit.
Oh, and I guess one more thing. I just remembered that also her dad at one point starts thinking that she's trying to sneak out of the house tonight. Like, she's doing this whole, like, oh, I'm so tired, I'm going to go to bed early, bye. And, like, she runs upstairs and tries to, she obviously pretends to go to bed, but doesn't do a very good job.
And then there's me when I'm really tired.
And you just pass out. But, yeah, he's convinced that she's going to try and sneak out. So she unhooks the, or he unhooks the battery cables from her truck so that she can't go anywhere. Which struck me as being kind of terrible kinda parenting. Weird. Yeah, I was just like, A, her truck is apparently so noisy that you can hear it all the way across town. So even if she even if she started your truck, you would know
also, as soon as she tried. I mean, why don't you just like, hey, are you like sneaking out at night?
Yeah.
You're not allowed to do that.
It's also like, B, it's a tiny ass town. What kind of trouble is she possibly going to get into? Especially when her dad is the chief of police. And C, it's a tiny ass town. If she goes anywhere, you're going to hear about it the next day anyway. What the hell, Dad? I don't know. I know I've added in a whole bunch of, oh, and also this, and also this, and one more thing, but the last thing that I have in my notes that I absolutely have to share because it was infuriating and kind of encapsulates how all of this book went. When Edward is talking to Bella for the first time of how he's been sneaking into her house at night to watch her sleep, bad, he says, quote, could this really be it? Was I to have no punishment at all for my outrageous behavior? This felt more like a reward. I knew I owed her a deeper penance, end quote. So it's basically, I'm doing all this bad shit, and nothing bad is happening. So I'm just going to keep doing it.
Not great.
Great guy. All right. It was all very strange. I'm going to stop because I've been at this for so long.
Okay.
And I want to know what your book is.
Let's take a break.
Yes. All right. Now I get to finally find out what book you've been reading.
Right. Very exciting. Let me bring out the book.
Mm. So he made his own custom dust jacket.
Yes. This is a custom... VDB dust jacket, very different books
incorporated.
Yeah. Whatever it was. You ready?
Mm-hmm. Reveal.
Okay,
show me the thing. It's like unwrapping a Christmas present.
It is, because I used wrapping paper.
Exactly. Ooh.
I should have gotten you to guess. I mean, right. Well, I guess you said you never.
I never would have, and honestly I probably will never try if we do.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that you mentioned, like, you could have just gotten a book from work, because that's exactly what I did. Uh-huh. I chose.
So you could have literally picked any book in the world, and I would have just been like,
any
sure.
Book in the world? Damn, well, it's just one store.
You know what I mean.
Anyway, the book I chose is The Children of Men by P.D. James.
Bring it. You still want to watch that movie at some point, I take it.
Yes, I do want to watch the movie. The movie looks really interesting. This book is from, like, 1991 or 2, I think, maybe 3 or 4.
Okay.
So it's, you know, 25-ish years old. This is the first book by P.D. James I've ever read.
I don't think I've read it. I'm assuming he, she, them?
It's, I believe she's a woman. She, okay. She was a woman. She's passed away now.
Oh, okay.
Can't read P.D. and not think police department.
The sad thing is, like, I default to the James part and I go with James Patterson and I just...
I don't think he's going to be entering into this podcast unless you decide to read one. So.
I mean, in all honesty, if I did read something of the James Patterson... universe, it would probably be one of his kids' books, and even then I don't know if I could handle doing that.
One's maybe... called like I Funny or something.
Oh god, I'm excited now because I know that you've been interested in the movie for a while, and I hadn't even really thought about the book.
It kind
ever.
Of came out of nowhere, honestly. It just showed up at the store and I was like, oh okay, I'll read that. I don't, it's really hard to explain what attracts me to specific books. I really like a lot of classics, but I also read a lot of like kind of weird stuff, and I just feel like, you know, it's a thing. I just see a book and I'm like, oh yeah, I'll read that one. And it's almost kind of arbitrary, but it's just how I work. So
imagine trying to buy you a Christmas present.
I kind of have a superpower. It's just like, I know what I want to read. Kind of.
Yes. So tell okay. me about this thing.
I just made the mistake of looking at Goodreads. There's a lot of like negative reviews. I don't even know why.
Really?
I looked at Goodreads. I never look at Goodreads. I'm glad I did though. I'll get into that a little bit later.
Please do.
Yeah, it seemed like quite a few people were like, the movie is much better than the book. And
you don't often hear that.
Yeah, it's quite rare that people would say that. I think the movie was very different than the book. Like, it's like an action movie, I think.
Yeah, I have seen it, but it was quite a few years ago, and I can't say I cared for it, but I also was probably a little young to have watched it, honestly. So I don't remember much.
But it's like action-y, right?
I believe so, yes.
Like, shit, like, explodes in that movie.
Yeah, there's supposed to be, like, a very famous scene of them all being in a car, and it's, like, a one-shot scene that was really difficult to film.
Isn't that whole movie done in one shot or something?
No.
No?
I don't think that's possible.
No, it's definitely possible.
Well, it'd be very difficult.
Hold on.
Google break.
Okay, it uses several lengthy single-shot sequences.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine trying to do, like, a decent 1.5 hour movie in a single shot, because there is
at least one movie that has done that.
Anyway.
Anyway, so yeah, I think a lot of people probably compare the movie and the book. I feel like the movie is loosely based on the book, but it's not really probably at all what the book is like.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm hoping I can make it kind of funny. It's a pretty serious book, which I'll go over in a minute. If you're interested in reading it, you should feel free to not get it spoiled for yourself right now, because I'm going to do that. I feel we're giving spoiler warnings this one. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you don't really need that.
Yeah, more interesting.
Now, that said, the plot of Children of Men is quite a bit more complex than Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, even like thematically.
Okay.
Thematically, it was kind of harder to pinpoint some stuff. Like, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde honestly is obvious compared to Children of Men.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say this book is much more subtle. It runs a little deeper, for sure.
Okay.
On the topic of why I chose this book, though, I know I just said that, like, I don't know why I choose books, but I have ideas.
Mm-hmm.
What I was thinking of is, like, it's set in, like, a dystopian world, and it's also kind of about the pending apocalypse in the book, which is interesting. I really like apocalyptic stuff. That's really interesting to me. I don't think I've read that many books that are apocalyptic. I couldn't really think of one off the top of my head. Like, I read The War of the Worlds, which isn't really like an apocalypse, but, like, you know, there's definitely a huge amount of disorder in the book.
Yes.
You know, from the whole, like, invasion thing. Yeah, I don't know. But I'm kind of fascinated with the idea of the so-called apocalypse, and, like, kind of mass disorder, I think, is really interesting in a horrifying way.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Dystopia and apocalyptic stuff, fascinating. It's interesting to me how fascinated we are with that stuff. Like, you know, dystopian fiction is kind of a newer concept as far as, like, human history goes. Like, I think the first dystopian themes or, like, books started to emerge probably, like, after 1850-ish. Like, fairly contemporary.
Yeah. I see what you mean now.
In the grand scheme of things.
I was just like, when was 1984 written? Like, I just kind of
that
blanked,
one
but, yeah.
was... I think it was written in 1948.
I think, yeah, I believe,
and then it was published the next year. I think it was roughly 1948, because that's how he decided 1984, as he flipped the 4 and the 8.
Oh, that was it.
That's okay. A little,
I didn't know that.
I think a lot of people were like, oh, it must be, like, set then, but that's not really relevant.
Okay.
Yeah. Really like that book. But what was I saying? Dystopia, it's becoming more and more common of a concept. And I think that's partially maybe because of the globalized world and stuff. People seem to think about tyranny a lot more. And I think particularly in the 20th century, we saw a lot more tyranny. And we got to see, like, those extremes. I think that really fostered the ideas of the dystopia or the dystopic. So yeah, I think it definitely became a lot more common as time went on, just because of that. And we've all kind of become fascinated with, like, how bad could it be?
Yes.
The interesting thing about Children of Men in the context of dystopia is it's, like, it's almost like I would say, like, it's dystopia light.
Okay.
Like, it's a dystopia, sure, but it's not as bad as 1984. Like, you're not perpetually being watched unless you're a dissident in this book.
Gotcha.
It, like, the weight of the dystopia is not as heavy in this book, I would say.
Hmm.
Yeah. Not to say that it isn't there, because it 100% is. And, like, there's definitely some fucked up stuff in the book. But yeah. The other thing that I wanted to talk about with the whole apocalypse and dystopia thing, which I was thinking about kind of shortly after we recorded our last podcast, which is, like, you often see the dystopia or the apocalypse, but you don't really see how we got there in the book.
That's true.
And I think what ended up drawing me to this book is it's kind of set in the pre-apocalypse.
Oh.
This is the preamble to the end of the world.
Okay.
Because in this book, now I jump into the plot.
Sorry, I was just going to say, because the only thing, I'm assuming it kind of has the same sort of thing, but isn't it basically like there's no kids, or like there's no babies being born?
Yeah.
That's all I've got. That's all I have for knowledge of.
I'm like, let me tell my story.
Sorry.
It's all good. It's all good. It's kind of interesting. The book is set in the current year.
Okay.
So the year that we're recording this podcast, 2021, is the year the book is set, which I also thought was interesting that I didn't really mean to do that. It just kind of happened.
So it actually like specifies 2021?
It is set in 2021. Huh. It starts on January 1st, 2021.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Neat.
Yeah. And so basically about 25 years ago at this point in this world, everyone just stopped being able to have children. So it doesn't really go into super detail, like if it's like a women thing or a men thing, like whether people can't produce like fertile eggs or sperm anymore. But okay. Either way, nobody can have children anymore. And the book actually starts by saying like the last recorded human birth, who is turning like 25 or something, died.
Oh.
Yeah. And it was like big international news.
Yeah. Like the youngest person on Earth.
Yeah. Because the youngest person recorded birth on Earth, the last recorded person born just died.
Wow.
And that's how the book starts. So it kind of starts on this ominous note.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I think it was in 1994. It might have been 1995, though. They call it Omega. So it's basically that's the year that everyone stopped being able to have children.
Okay.
So the book itself, the protagonist is a man named Theo. I'll tell you a little bit about him. He has character development through the novel, which I appreciate.
I'm curious as to why you specified that.
That he has character development?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like in a lot of the books I read, people don't develop very much.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if character development was a thing back then. Oh, okay. That's not quite true. I don't know.
Okay.
But like, it's kind of interesting because he starts out as being quite crass, I think.
Mm.
And like, he doesn't seem to care very much about other people. Kind of indifferent, kind of focused on his own stuff. He seems to not have like a lot of positive things to say about other people.
Okay.
Yeah, that's Theo. He teaches like history at a college, which is kind of interesting because his career is becoming more and more irrelevant because there's no future. So people don't really care about history anymore.
Oh, saying it that way just makes it sound so dark.
What?
There's no future anymore, so, you know.
Well, yeah, whatever. I mean, that's the reality of the novel, though. If there was no people being born anymore.
Yeah.
And, like, well, that's kind of one of the driving forces of some of the stuff that's happening, because this book is set in England.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, essentially the country is starting to fall apart,
because
they're like, okay, we're not going to take care of these roads anymore, because there's no point, because there's not going to be enough people soon.
Right.
And they're starting to... I don't know if it's really forcing people to migrate. I think they're heavily suggesting or recommending people to, because they're like, there's not going to be services to where you're living anymore. Everyone needs to move together so that it's easier to facilitate there being services to them still. Because it's like, you know, if their last youngest person is 25 years old, think of what the average age is, right? Like most people are in their 50s probably.
I mean, I guess, but then, I mean, people still live to be, you know, 80, 90.
Yeah, but most people don't work when they're 80 or 90.
That's true.
So, like, you know, you're kind of, not to say that you can't be productive at an old age, but like...
It just tapers off considerably.
Yeah, for sure. I think most people aren't really able to do the things you can do when you're 25, when you're 80.
Yep.
That kind of plays into. So, basically, the world is starting to fall apart. And that's what I mean when it's the pre-apocalypse, because you see like how it's going to become the apocalypse. And we're not really there yet, but it's definitely starting to happen.
It's on the way.
So yeah, Theo teaches history. As I said, he's kind of become a relic a little bit. What he does isn't super relevant. He's really interested in history. Most people aren't now in the book because there's not really much point if you think about it. His cousin is the warden of England, so he's kind of the self-made top of government. He's described as being like a despot. Okay. How do you say that?
Despot. I don't know why, but for a second I thought you were going to say desk bitch.
He's a desk bitch. He just works in his office.
Anyway.
Yeah, so he's like a dictator, basically.
Hmm.
The novel kind of starts out, or the action of the novel starts out, is he takes a course over for a friend of his, or maybe an acquaintance, so that the friend can go on vacation. It's kind of lined up. He wants to go on this vacation really badly, so he convinces Theo to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's an English literature course. At the course, he meets a young woman named Julian. I don't know how young she really is. I don't think it says in the book. I kind of want to Google it because they're supposed to like fall in love and he's old.
Oh, actually, I kind of remember that maybe being a thing in the film.
Well, apparently in the film, he's like a civil servant or something.
So already a departure there.
Oh, yeah. It's way different. When you Google how old the first one is, Canada.
How old Canada?
How old is Canada?
We're 154 or something.
Eh, whatever. So I don't know how old she is. I assume she's probably in her 30s.
Okay.
I mean, that's kind of interesting too, because that would be like the new young person.
Right.
And the people who were born right before Omega happens are called Omegas, and they're like kind of treated specially. They're kind of pampered because they're like the last children.
They treat them well. They're the only ones we have.
Yeah, pretty much. Huh. So yeah, I have no idea how old Julian is. I don't even know if she's a young woman. Now I'm just like, was she a young woman? Was she? Oh, hold on.
Like, I was trying to think of other books by P.D. James that I've seen. Because, like, I've obviously heard of Children of Men.
Mostly wrote mysteries.
Yeah, because I think she wrote, like, I think, like, Death at Pemberley.
Yeah, I think
so. One of the, yeah, that's one I see all the time. Anyway.
Yeah, so anyway. So he takes over that course and meets Julian. Let's describe Julian briefly. She's, like, the other major character of the novel. She's super religious, we find out.
Okay.
She's, like, I describe her in this as kind of a low-key manic pixie dream girl.
Oh,
because okay. In a way, like, she brings him out of his, like, misanthropy.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a little bit of that. Like, she kind of shows him.
She kind of has that vague energy to her.
Yeah, for sure. Because, okay. Like, he's all, like, sad and depressed and not happy with life and life sucks. And then he's like, oh, you give my life meaning.
This woman walks in and, ooh.
Pretty much. A sort of low-key manic pixie dream girl, but she's religious. That's what I wrote down. So Julian in the course starts a kind of a fight about characters in the book A Portrait of a Lady by Henry James. So Theo was like not excited for the course, but he's kind of interested by her because she's making more of a scene and he kind of appreciates that, a little lively discussion.
Okay.
Probably doesn't get that a lot. So yeah, then Theo later in the book stops in a chapel. Because he likes the song they sing, the songs that they sing, he's not really religious. Hmm. He sees that woman from the chorus, Julian, and she approaches him. We learned that her index finger and her middle finger are fused together.
Okay.
Which I thought was interesting in the context of the podcast, which I will talk about in a second.
Okay.
Which has spared her from having her fertility tested.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay, because they're just like, well, there's no point because you have a thing that's...
Yeah, basically. So there's like an ableism in the society. And, well, essentially they're practicing eugenics because they're testing people to try to find fertile people.
Mm-hmm.
But they're only testing people who are like perfect, well, basically.
There's obviously nothing wrong with you. So
yeah,
we'll,
so it's
we'll
like,
test you.
Oh, your fingers are fused together, not you. Or it's like, you're, I don't know, too loud. Not you, probably, I assume.
Too loud.
Where does it stop with eugenics, really?
Yeah. Slippery slope.
So yeah, she doesn't have to have her fertility checks. But I thought it was interesting in the podcast because I was talking about kind of the ableist voice that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde has written. Mm. And this is a much more contemporary book. So it depicts ableism and eugenics, but it does it in a way that isn't offensive.
Okay.
Because it does mention this, her fingers being fused together. And it shows how the society she lives in is treating her differently because of it. But it's just a part of like the world building, and it's the difference between that and Dr. Jekyll is that in that book the author expects you to share his unenlightened view about, you know, people with disabilities. So it's kind of interesting. She's like, this is a horror story, this should be horrible to you.
Right.
I thought that was interesting. Yeah, hope that made sense.
I think so.
Word salad. Okay, so Julian requests that Theo come to meet her group of dissidents at a chapel that is basically not being used very much.
Mm.
And Theo agrees. He kind of doesn't want to, but she convinces him. So then he gets requested by an old mentor of his named Jasper to visit him. Jasper asks if he can move in with Theo, which is relevant later. And we also meet his wife, Hilda, who used to be like a really sharp ton, very clever academic. But now has something kind of going on with her. It's not stated what, but her faculties are clearly degrading.
Okay.
So they talk for a little bit. We're introduced to the idea kind of when you're first reading it, it doesn't really occur to you that it means anything. But they're talking about the quietus, which is described as like a socially sanctioned mass suicide of people who are getting to be too old.
Ooh.
So I think it's basically like they don't want to take care of old people or they don't have the manpower to. So the state is basically like, you should kill yourself.
Lovely.
Yeah. I mean, it's a dystopia for sure.
Love your country, kill yourself.
So anyway, he meets the group of dissidents. They're called the Five Fishes. I think it's a religious thing. And
yeah.
So they want him to use what they think is his influence with the Warden of England to change some of the current social policies that the government is enforcing. So he's basically like, I don't actually have any influence at all. He used to be an advisor to the Warden of England, but he didn't feel like he was making a difference at all, which is why he resigned from it.
He's like, if no one's going to listen to me, why am I even bothering?
I think that was at least part of why he resigned. Because okay. He's like, well, you know, I don't actually have any power, so what's the point of doing this? So they argue about him trying to use his influence. Theo seems pretty indifferent at this point to how things are in the world. He's just kind of doing his thing. So they convince him to go see a quietus. And so he goes to this kind of out-of-the-way village. And the group is like, of course it's out of the way. They don't want people to go see it.
Yeah.
Because he's basically like, well, it's inconvenient for me to go. And they're like, yeah, that's the point.
It's like, we don't want most people just happening upon this because it's really unpleasant.
Yeah, so he goes to see the quietus. And he sees all the old people kind of gathered onto a boat. The way they do it is they put them all on a boat and drown them.
Oh.
Which I think is kind of patently ridiculous.
It seems impractical.
I think if you were really going to make people die and basically claim that they're choosing to, you'd probably choose a less painful way than drowning.
Mm-hmm. Also, like, it seems like it'd be really slow and, like, everything about it just, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think they're basically, like, shackled to the boat and then the boat sinks, I think, is how it works. It doesn't tell you, though. It's kind of left to your imagination.
Also, waste of a boat. Anyway.
Well, exactly. That's what I mean. It just seems really inefficient to do it that way. But
okay.
So, yeah, he goes to see the quietus. He sees the old people on the boat. And then a commotion starts. One of the people on the boat jumps into the water. And Theo kind of instinctively goes towards her. Which I think kind of starts to suggest maybe he isn't so indifferent about the world after all. Because he doesn't really have a reason to try to help this person. But for whatever reason, he's compelled to go into the water to try to help her. And so he's kind of horrified to see that the woman who jumped off the boat is Hilda, Jasper's wife.
Ooh.
So when Jasper was talking about moving in with him kind of very shortly after, and they're talking about the quietus, suddenly now Hilda's a part of it. And it kind of leads you to wonder, like, did Jasper choose this for her? It's kind of hard to tell. You're not really given that information because Jasper wants to move in with Theo.
Yeah, that's uncomfortable.
But part of why that wouldn't have worked is that Hilda wouldn't be able to climb the stairs at Theo's place. So it's like, it's hard to tell if that's something. Or if she just got to the age, whatever age it is, maybe it's 70, where they're like, okay, you're too old now, you have to die. So yeah, he's pretty horrified to see that that's her. And he reaches out to her and he's about to help her when she's struck in the side of the head with a pistol by a soldier.
Oh.
So, and then he's like, ah, oh, what are you doing? And he's also struck. He's knocked unconscious. And he awakes to find he's on a beach. And he's all disheveled because he's been attacked. So basically, when they ask him to go see the quietus, it has the desired effect. And he sees that, like, yeah, the quietus isn't what they say it is. It's not really suicide. I shouldn't say suicide. That's not really a kind way to say that. It's not really people choosing to kill themselves.
Yeah.
It's the government forcing people to die. And he also suspects that the people who were on the boats, he thinks some of them were drugged.
Oh.
Like, he doesn't think they were there by choice at
all. So it's basically a government-sanctioned murder.
Yeah, it's quite ominous. But he thinks, having seen that, and I mean, it's pretty hard when someone's trying to escape and you see a soldier, like, murder them.
For sure.
And it's someone you know. Yeah, so he awakes. He finds a hotel. He stays the night. The next morning, he asks the proprietor of the hotel about the quietus, and she denies that there was one. Which is kind of interesting. I don't think that's in there for like, because I don't think it's because the government is like making people not talk about it. I just think it's like, it's easier to deny the horror of it than to kind of face it.
If you ignore it and don't think about it, then what effect can it have?
But on I
you?
Think also there's like the piece of it that's like, there is like a security police in the novel. Oh, okay. Like there's like a state police. And I feel like, you know, if you're a dissident, like they go after you. So that could be a part of it too. She's like, oh no, there's no quietus here. So yeah, probably, I think also, like, she might have just not wanted to talk about it because there was an incident at it, so it's, like, probably not allowed to be spoken about. So he decides he is going to see the Warden of England. His name is Zan. X-A-N.
Okay.
So he gets in to see Zan in the council. They're immediately super aggressive towards him. They kind of have a counterpoint for every point that he brings up. The group has asked him to talk about several things. Like, for example, he's like, I saw the quietus. It wasn't voluntary. It was horrible. Immediately, they're like, that was a mismanaged quietus. It's not usually like that. That was completely irregular. Oof. They have an answer for every single grievance he brings up. And they basically say they don't care about what he's saying to them, that they feel like they're doing their job well, and they need to plan for the end of humanity. And so they basically, like, everything they say justifies what they're doing. And it's kind of interesting.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, for sure. It is kind of interesting, though, because it's written in such a way that like you kind of see their point,
mm-hmm.
where like it's quite realistic, like the answers they're giving you. Like I could see how that's like a valid counterpoint to what he's saying, which is good writing on that part. So yeah, what they say is like their goals is to give people peace and comfort during like the end times, mm-hmm. and that's what they're doing. So the request of the group to the council are basically completely denied, and the council realizes pretty much immediately that he isn't operating by himself,
right?
Because they're like, why are you bringing this up to us? And he, one of the other characters in the novel named Miriam, her brother went to the Isle of Man, which is like the penal colony of England now. So they send all the criminals there. And her brother went there and it was like horrible. And there's no law there. And like there's not a government and there's no basically like amenities for normal life there at all.
Well, I guess there's no reason for there to be, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It's who cares about the criminals?
It's like, yeah, the people are undesirable. So they just don't really need like normal stuff.
Which is kind of.
But her brother escapes and gets back to her.
Right.
And so he's like, oh, it's horrible. Don't let them take me or whatever. And so then they find him and take him.
Hmm.
And then I believe he's killed. I don't really remember how that worked, but basically Miriam knows he's killed, but she lets Theo know about that, which partially convinces him to go see the Quietus and stuff like that.
Okay.
And so he's like, okay, these are my grievances. At least I think that's the order that it went in. It could be that was after. I don't remember. It doesn't matter. But so he's like, what about the Isle of Man? There's all these horrible things happening there. And they're like, we know that. How do you know that?
Ooh.
So he kind of accidentally lets it slip. So they're pretty immediately aware of the fact that he's been in touch with dissidents. So yeah, now the group is in danger because the government knows what they're doing.
Whoopsie.
So after the meeting, he talks briefly with Zan, who's his cousin. They used to be quite close. They grew up together. And Zan's like, he's basically like, look, I know you've been talking to people who oppose my rule. He's like, I'm going to do whatever I need to do, so you should probably just stop doing that.
Oh.
Yeah. So he meets again with Julian. He says that the group is in danger. The council isn't going to do anything. They're denying their request. And he's like, I told you it wasn't going to work. I don't actually have any power. And, you know, things are pretty good, so maybe you should just drop it.
Mm.
They part ways. The group publishes a list of demands, kind of semi-anonymously. So the demands are, number one, call a general election and put your policies before the people. Number two, give the sojourners full civil rights, including the right to live in their own homes, to send for their families, and to remain in Britain at the end of their contract of service. So the sojourners are, they're basically working immigrants.
Okay.
So it's like young people imported to England to do kind of like hard labor and like menial jobs that other people don't want to do or can't do. And those people don't have like full civil rights, like they live in camps. And once they turn 60, they're forcibly removed from England.
Nice.
Yeah. The number three, abolish the Quietus. Number four, stop deporting convicted offenders to the Isle of Man penal colony and ensure that people already there can live in peace and decency. And number five, stop the compulsory testing of semen and the examination of young women and shut down the public porn shops.
That last little one kind of threw me for a loop there.
The porn chops?
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like a part of like one of the ways that the state tries to like get people to have an interest in reproduction is like state porn chops. I feel like that comes from like the religion side of the book. Because a lot of this book has themes of like religion as morality and stuff like that. Like Julian's very religious. She's also probably the most moral person. Maybe not in the novel.
Okay.
But she kind of sees what's happening with the government, and even though life is generally good for people in England, she sees the kind of atrocities that are going on as well, so she's able to kind of move past the fact that like they don't super directly affect her.
Gotcha.
So then Theo gets a visit from the state police. He doesn't really tell them anything. He kind of uses his influence, his cousin of the warden, a little bit. He does have some influence there, like even just being related to him kind of carries an influence.
Okay.
He does see Julian randomly again in a shop, and he warns her that they're looking for the group. He then decides to go on vacation.
So you can still have a vacation.
Yeah.
All right.
Part of that is like him having, like being related to the Warren. Because a lot of people don't get to leave England, I think. But he's allowed to go onto the continent.
Okay.
Were you going to say something else?
No, I was just asking where he was going on vacation.
Yeah, so he goes on vacation to Europe. And then he gets back. As soon as he's back, Miriam shows up. And he's like, one of the group has been captured by the state police. And they're going on the run and they need his help. And we find out that Julian is pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So she's the first pregnant woman in like 25 years.
Holy shit.
Yeah, so it's quite special, But it's kind of interesting because, so it's like, because she wasn't being tested, because they think that she has something wrong with her, mm-hmm. they don't discover that she is in fact fertile. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't really believe that she's pregnant. A lot of people have been like, I'm pregnant over the years, because it's like,
it would be a big deal. Yeah. Like, ooh, look at me.
There's such a big trauma that like people have like crazy responses to it. Like there's people, like a big trend in the book is like christening animals.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's like, instead of getting your baby christened, you would get like your animals
like
christened.
Your dog.
Yeah. And okay. like people push around animals in strollers and stuff, and like they treat them like their children.
I mean, like some people already do that.
But... yeah, exactly. But it becomes like common, yes. because that's one of the ways people are right. dealing with it.
Okay.
He goes back to the group. He hears like the baby kicking and feels it. So he's like, oh my God, you actually are pregnant. Mm-hmm. So he's like, okay, I have to help them. We meet kind of the group a little bit in more detail. There's Rolf, the leader of the group. He's really like aggressive. He really doesn't like Theo. He's kind of like, he's very similar to Zan in a lot of ways, which comes up a bit later. So yeah, they decide to go on the run. So they go to Jasper's, but it's kind of cleverly set up because we know that Jasper wanted to move in with Theo.
Right.
So now Theo has something that he can kind of barter with Jasper with. He's like, okay, ooh. You can move into my place, but I need you to help me go on the run. So that's the plan. He's like, I'm going to be able to convince him with that. And they go to Jasper because he thinks he can persuade him to give them his car.
I feel like I'm vaguely remembering this part of the movie.
Okay.
So I'm curious to see if it plays out as it's going in my head.
Yeah, so when they get there, Jasper has killed himself.
Yeah.
Okay. There's one bullet left in the gun he used to kill himself, which Theo takes. And Miriam's like, don't let Rolf or Julian know you have that. Rolf's going to try to take it from you, and Julian's going to tell you to get rid of it.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. I like Miriam. She's a very down-to-earth character. Yeah, so they get a whole bunch of supplies from Jasper's. They're really well set up. They have a car. They're heading towards Wales. Rolf and him have kind of been arguing back and forth, so now they have a private conversation. Rolf basically says he wants to be the new Warden of England. He thinks that he has the power to do that because Julian's pregnant. He thinks it's his child. We find out it's actually not.
Oh, okay.
They're kind of married, or at least together. Hmm. So yeah, Rolf is like...
I just imagine if Maury had still been a thing,
yeah,
there would have been this whole...
like, you are not the father. Man, if this is my child, I'm going to take such good care of it. I'm going to be there for you every day, I swear to God. All right. You are not the father. I'm out of here. I don't care about you and your kid. I knew it.
I don't care if it is the first baby in 25 years. Yeah, I'm out.
Exactly. That's how it goes.
Okay, anyways.
yeah. So yeah, Rolf is basically like, I want to be the new Warden of England. He shows that his values don't really line up with the group. Because they're, like, when they send out that kind of list of demands, like, it's very clear that they want things to be done in kind of a moral way. Yes. They're asking for more rights for people. And then Rolf is basically like, I don't really care about any of that. And he basically says, kind of verbatim, that he's just going to keep doing everything the council's already doing.
Oh,
and okay. It's kind of an interesting back and forth with him, between him and Theo, because he's like, what about the Sojourners? And he's like, yeah, well, I mean, you know, I'll deal with them when the time comes. And he's like, yeah, well, I think that's what the warden. Well, he's like, well, that's what the warden would say, too. He's dealing with them right now.
Okay.
And that's like basically it. Because right now, the way the council is, it's like it's all about priorities, and they have to do things to make sure that their number one goal is met. And then they're going to worry about other stuff.
Well, what's the point of you being new warden if you're just going to do all the same shit? What is...
Well, I mean, it's kind of an interesting commentary on power, too, because it's like, that's how it works. There's a revolution, and then you're back to the same old shit, because people who are drawn to power are inherently immoral.
Kind of the same.
Yeah. For sure. I think that's like a thing in the book, is the inherent immorality of power. Mm. So, yeah. Basically, he says he's going to keep doing everything the council's doing. He makes it clear that he thinks because he got Julian pregnant that people are just going to hand power over to him as soon as they find out he's the father. Which, okay. Yeah, spoiler, he isn't even the father.
Hmm.
Theo's basically like, yeah, that's not going to work for you. Which I think is true, because the Warden of England is power hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see why he would care.
No.
If you can have children. What he's going to do is he's going to take your ability to have children and use it for himself. Which is what Theo says.
Okay.
Yeah, like, for example, if you had fertile sperm. Okay, they're just going to essentially milk you for sperm, and then they're going to use that, which is proven later to be true.
Ugh.
Not that specifically, but it's proven that like they're not just going to give him power.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's like, why would you? Power begets power. If you're power hungry, you're not going to just like let go of it.
No.
Look at Donald Trump.
Because that wouldn't serve you. Okay.
Which, I mean, this is part of the book that makes the ending seem a little ridiculous. I think the ending is a little flawed, which I'll talk about more.
Okay.
Rolf takes over driving because he's really aggressive and he doesn't want Theo to be in control. And then he's driving like stupid and punctures the tire immediately. So they're trying to change the tire. They're having a lot of trouble. Their flashlight goes out and they're basically forced to just spend the night and the next day because they're only traveling at night to avoid the police in kind of like this like clearing hidden from the road. So it's kind of interesting at this point. Theo starts to find like a camaraderie with the group. He's discovers he actually really enjoys the time that he spends with them, which is funny because initially he kind of rejected them. He was like, I don't really want to be involved in this because I think he's starting to see that like he does agree with some of these things a little bit.
Okay.
And I think their values are starting to line up a bit more. Because originally, I think he just thinks it's really immature and naive. And he's like, this is pointless. You're never going to succeed. So you shouldn't even bother.
Yay.
But yeah. So now that he's like outside of like their terrible society, I think he kind of, they start to have like a more human interaction.
Right.
Theo's growing a little bit as a character. Okay. So he decides he's not going to keep the diary anymore. So now we're just switching to third person narrator for the rest of the book. And a really weird thing that happens next is they get attacked by a group called the Painted Faces.
Okay.
Which are basically Omegas who paint their faces and like attack people and stuff. It's kind of ridiculous. I'm not even really sure what the point of it being in the novel is.
So they don't really have like a function beyond.
I mean, maybe their function is to like kill one of the characters and move the plot forward because they lose the car in the attack.
Okay.
So they lose the car and all their supplies. But I don't know. It just strikes me as being kind of stupid. Like they're a group of Omegas who are like highly educated and they're highly respected. Not really. They're not really respected, but they're treated super differently than other people.
Okay.
They're kind of held up in a pedestal their entire lives. They get special treatment because they're the last generation. And yeah, for some reason, they like burn the car and kill one of them. And they get really primal and they're like whooping and dancing around. It's kind of racist, honestly.
This is just, I don't know. I don't see that as being terribly far-fetched, honestly.
Well, it's just like, I just don't really see, like they still live in a civilized society. Like you're not allowed to murder people in the world. No. So it's like, why is, like,
but that doesn't mean that people won't get rowdy or like have a riot just because, like, I was
no
thinking,
it's not a riot though.
It's not,
it's
just
like, it's almost like tribal.
Oh,
and like,
okay,
they all paint their faces and they surround the car. Oh, and they're like whooping.
Okay.
And banging.
Okay,
on
gotcha.
The car.
I was,
and they have like a fire, they
else.
Burn out the car and they murder one of the group.
Okay.
And like, it's not the first time and it's not random, like they just do this, like it's a thing they do with these Omegas. They're the painted faces.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm like, for me, it just doesn't, it smacks as really unrealistic. I think it's really kind of dumb.
It's like she kind of wanted to have like a Lord of the Flies thing happen.
Yeah, I guess. I think maybe she just wanted to show like the degradation of like civilization. Because she's like, well, the world's going to end. So some people might go like a little crazy.
So it's going to be the pampered ones who have been basically given everything on a plate because they're the babies.
Yeah. I'm like, I don't know. I just think, I like, the Omegas think they're superior to everyone, which I guess kind of explains it. But like,
but then they go tribal.
Well, yeah, it just doesn't really make that much sense to me. I can't explain it super well. So like, we're going to keep going.
Alrighty.
Yeah. So instead of waving his gun around, they kind of, they're discussing what to do. They're not sure. They decide that they're just kind of going to kind of mimic the dancing that they're doing and try to get over this kind of wall thing.
Okay.
One of the people in the group called Luke dies, but the others get away.
Like dies or is killed. Kind of thing.
Oh yeah, sorry, he's killed.
Okay.
Because like, he's trying to like distract them.
Oh, okay.
Or sorry, as Julian's starting to escape, one of them goes after her and then Luke grabs him and then they all just like club him to death basically. So it's quite graphic.
Okay.
Yeah. So after they get away, Rolf asks Miriam whose child Julian is carrying. And she doesn't really respond. He's like, whose kid is she pregnant with? Here's the Maury moment. And then, which is really weird. It's like, why don't you just ask Julian? She's right there.
Yeah, it's like she would know.
But, oh yeah, Miriam's a midwife. That's very relevant to the novel. Probably could have dropped that one earlier.
Okay.
Might edit this in. Julian's like, well, why don't you ask me? And she's like, he's like, who's the child? And she's like, it's Luke's. So it's Theo's. It's not Theo's. It's not Rolf's child.
But now dad's gone.
Yeah, it's Luke's. But it's they have a complex relationship and it's not like they were having an affair. What she says is like, she just liked how much Luke loved her.
Okay.
Basically. And like, he was really in love with her. They slept together once. She kind of did it to get back at Rolf.
Oh.
Which is a part of that thing where it's like, she's not, like I say, she's probably the most moral character in the novel, but then she also did that.
She's still got a bit of gray in there.
Well, yeah, it's definitely a little gray for sure.
That's sad about the dad, though.
Yeah, so he is murdered. Mm. So that's a thing. So Rolf starts to freak out a little bit. He's kind of like abusing himself on a tree. He's like rubbing his face on a tree.
That's an interesting way to phrase
that. Yeah.
Abusing himself on a tree.
He's kind of self-harming a little bit. He's really upset. But then he gets over it really fast because he's like one of those weird psychopathic power-hungry people who's like that. We also find out that Luke was also exempt from testing because he had epilepsy when he was a child, which is like, wow, what a stupid reason to not test somebody. He doesn't even have epilepsy anymore, and you're telling me you're going to not allow him to have children for that? That's ridiculous.
Just in case.
But yeah, basically, so these two people who are not perfect are the people who are going to have children because, you know, that's how it goes. So a little while later, they go to sleep, they wake up, and Rolf is gone. He's left. They pretty immediately realize that he's going to inform on them because I think he felt like his position of power
has been threatened.
Got kind of swept out. Like, he doesn't really have as much now. He isn't the father, so he's not really going to be able to be like, look, I'm going to be able to procreate and make the world ours again.
I can't refather the planet.
That's right. So he's going to try to vie for power out of the current situation. It's not his child. Maybe he doesn't care. Maybe he's just going to lie and say it is his. Either way, they kind of realize immediately that he's going to go to the warden and that they need to go. So Julian is going to be having the baby very soon. That's kind of their like lucky break because Rolf didn't think the baby was going to be born for like a month or something.
Okay.
So they're definitely going to have the state police after them right away. So they need a new car. This part's kind of interesting. Theo breaks into the home of an old couple and forces them to give him supplies and their car at gunpoint.
I think I remember that point too.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting scene for Theo because he's doing something that's very bad, but it's also quite a humanizing scene for him because he's very like good to them.
Okay.
Even though he's robbing them. And like he's like, I don't really want to do this to you, but I kind of have to. And he doesn't seem to be enjoying it at all. It's like a pure necessity that he's doing this, but he ties them up. He gives them water. He's about to leave and he discovers that the woman needs to use the washroom. So instead of having her, like, use the washroom, like, in her clothes on the bed that he's tied them to, he unties her and lets her use the washroom, which I think is quite humanizing for him, that he's choosing to put these people's, like, comfort above
and
his
like
necessity, like, his need.
Yeah.
Because he really does need to go. Like, the police are going to get them soon. And he has this moment where he's like, I don't really have time to, like, untie her. And then he's like, no, I have to do it. And he unties her and lets her go to the washroom. And like I said, he gave them water. Like, he wasn't, like, that bad to these people, given that he was robbing them. And then after he brings the woman back, he's like, okay, well, you should probably go to the washroom, too, to the man.
It's like, while we're here, you may as well just make it happen.
Yep. So, yeah. So, he steals their stuff, and he goes. He remembers that he has, like, this kind of shack that he knows about out in the way. It's in, like, Witchwood or something. Someplace in England called Witchwood. And they decide that's where they're going to go to have Julian give birth to the child. So they arrive near the shack. They decide they're going to go on foot from there. They hear on the car's radio that the state police have discovered the robbery of the old couple. The radio also said the old woman died, which makes Theo feel pretty bad. It's also like really weird. When I first read it, I was almost like, is that like a ploy or something?
I was like, my brain is just like, did the police do something?
Yeah, I mean, that's it too. Like, if they were like, well, he was really good, actually.
Yeah.
Because he was really good to them. Did they murder the woman? I could kind of see that.
Yep.
But, yeah, he's feeling really bad about that. They hear helicopters overhead. They know that they're going to get caught soon. That's the kind of another dystopian aspect of the novel is, like, they're on the run, but, like, they know they're going to get caught. They get into the shack. Miriam's like, Theo, you should go for, like, a walk because we're going to have to give birth soon. And
always a fun experience.
Yeah. He returns to the shack and he's like, he kind of felt sent away. And he's like, I really want to be here for this. And they're like, good, we want you to be here too. It's kind of an interesting scene. At some point in the novel, I thought it was a little hammed up. Maybe not hammed up. It was a little like kind of played up. Not necessary. It was like Julian and Theo are starting to fall in love. Kind of. Okay. In like a really unromantic way.
Okay.
It's not romancy at all, but they're kind of like, they have feelings for each other. They're falling in love. Miriam's like, I think she loves you. Like, Theo's mentioned in the novel prior that he's starting to have feelings for her. At this point, he's like calling her darling. It's like, it's very strange to me. That part felt really weird.
That would, yeah.
Like, it didn't really fit the novel that well, in my opinion. I mean, but I also hate that criticism because people, I kept seeing comments where they're like, Like, this book could have been better. It should have been more like the movie. And I think that's not a valid criticism at all of this book. The book and the movie are totally different stories, and it's not fair to compare like an action movie to this more cerebral book.
Also, I'm just having this thought, like, if there's been no babies for 25 years, Miriam's a midwife, how has she been practicing all this time?
She hasn't been.
She's just going to have to remember and be like, I think I remember how all this
I mean, goes. That's like part of what Theo's arguments are. He's like, we should just tell the council you're pregnant. Miriam hasn't delivered a baby in 25 mm-hmm. years. She might not be able to do this. You could die. There might be complications. This is bigger than us. And they're like, basically, from Julian's point of view, the warden is evil and he represents immorality. And she's like, I don't want him to be anywhere near my child. Or me.
I mean, fair.
She's like, the birth will be tainted if he is present.
Right. I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah. But... I mean, she doesn't say that verbatim, but she definitely, like, believes that. Mm. Like, I really like the scene because, like, she's giving birth, but it's very, like, ubiquitous. When I was reading, my first thought was, like, humans have been giving birth the way that this is described for, like, literally, like, our entire history.
Yeah.
Like, it's, like, the man and the woman. And he's not the father, but, like, he's kind of... He wishes the child was his, he says at one point, which is really interesting because we find out very early on in the novel that he killed his child by accident.
Oh, no.
And it's been like, 25 plus years since that happened. Yeah. But like he accidentally ran her over with his car.
Oh, no.
Which is pretty awful. But like it's really strange because like he doesn't feel very bad about it. Or, like, he doesn't seem to. Like, he seems almost kind of indifferent about it. It's hard to tell if it's just because a lot of time has passed.
Mm.
Or what, but like that's part of his characterization, is that he doesn't seem very affected by it.
Huh.
But then it's part of that character growth that we see with him, that he's like, I wish this was my child. And I think for him it's like a second chance. Like there's a lot of kind of dramatic justice that he murdered his child and now he's helping bring in the first baby born in 25 years.
But now you also say like he murdered his child. So did he run?
Did I say murdered?
Yeah, I was just was it an accident?
No, it was an accident.
Okay.
He didn't mean to kill the baby.
Because that paints a very different picture.
That's a little judgmental, love me.
That paints a very different picture.
I mean, to be fair,
if
you run over a kid, that's definitely on you. Like,
yep.
You shouldn't be in a car if you're not ready to drive. You know?
Fair point.
Yeah, I mean, like, look behind you.
Yeah, slow down in residential
areas. That's a pretty gross scene early in the novel because he's like in his car and he feels the thud and he knows that he's ran over his child.
Oh.
And then his neighbor runs up and starts screaming. And he's like, get out of the car. What are you doing? And he's like, Theo's like so uncomfortable with it. He's like, I don't even want to get out of the car because getting out of the car is like facing the reality of what I've just done.
Oh.
Yeah, it's quite hard.
That's actually an interesting way of phrasing it because like usually, what was it? I think it was like some of the true crime stuff that we've been listening to where it's like when a parent has like murdered their kid and they call 911 and they're doing the whole like, oh, my baby is dead. My baby is dead. But it's like usually parents would be like, get someone here. But like my kid is in trouble. Like you don't want to believe your kid is dead until like there's nothing else that can be done. So that's kind of like an interesting look at it instead of being like, I cannot face what I just did. Instead of being like, maybe they're still okay. Maybe I can do something.
Yeah, like, for sure. I mean, like, I don't know. The novel's like fairly deep, I would say.
Yeah.
Part of me is like, I don't know how well it suits the podcast to do like a book like this because there's definitely like layers of subtlety that I can't really.
Fair.
I don't have time to get into.
I mean, I took so much time doing Goddamn Midnight.
I also wrote this script really fast. So, like, maybe if I do a book like this again, I'll put more effort in.
Mm.
But yeah, I just thought that was really interesting. Like, they're giving birth. And it's almost like they're in, like, a cave.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're just kind of cut off from the world. Very and, like, the midwife is helping her give birth. And he's, like, supporting her through it. And that's, like, a very human scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I feel like that's, like, a scene that's happened throughout history.
Yep.
Like billions of times, which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
Okay, so yeah, Miriam leaves to go look for more supplies in a nearby house because they lost all their supplies when the painted faces attack them. She's gone for an hour or longer. Julian starts to get worried. She asks Theo to check it out. She kind of suspects that Miriam is dead.
Mm-hmm.
Theo goes to the nearby house, discovers that Miriam has been murdered. She's been strangled.
Oof.
Theo vomits, which further emphasizes his kind of humanity that's starting to come out of him.
Mm.
So he hurries back to the shack with a couple supplies and he has a brief meal with Julian. Julian's like, I think they're here. And he goes out and Zan is out there. Because of course, Zan's like gone to talk to them by himself. Theo goes out to face him. So yeah, Rolf is dead. Julian's the only one left from the group that's alive now. Mm. Which is funny. It kind of is like, he was right. Of course, they weren't going to give power to Rolf. Rolf was a threat to the Warden's power, so he was killed almost immediately after they got what they needed out of him. Mm-hmm. Zan is unaware the child has already been born, so he's trying to convince Theo to join him. Theo refuses. Zan says he doesn't want to kill Theo, and Theo pulls out his revolver. Zan thinks it doesn't have a bullet in it because he knows about the old people robbery. During that robbery, Theo was like, don't worry, the gun isn't even loaded, because he's trying to make them comfortable.
Right.
So he thinks that he doesn't have a bullet. He's like, I don't want to kill you. And so then Zan pulls his gun out, but the baby cries. And so, I mean, you can imagine what a strange moment that would be.
Yeah.
Because Zan gets immediately distracted by it. He fires at Theo, but misses. Theo fires back at him, and he actually kills Zan. So it's like, it's kind of interesting. As soon as I read that there was one bullet in the book, I was like, oh, I wonder who that bullet's for, right?
That's got somebody's name on
it. Yeah, exactly. I was like, oh, I wonder how this ends. So he kills Zan. It's really interesting. As soon as he kills Zan, it kind of changes everything, which is really weird. Mm. This part is kind of dumb. So the Warden has been wearing like a coronation ring, I think, from like the royal family, just to like kind of show how powerful he is. So he puts on the Warden's ring, kind of symbolically shows that he's kind of usurped power from the Warden, which I think is really stupid.
Doesn't really sound like something he'd want to do with.
That's the other thing, which is it's really weird about him because he's not really presented as being power hungry at all.
Right.
But then kind of immediately, like as soon as the opportunity arrives, he's just like, I'm just going to step right into the Warden's position. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like he's expected to. But yeah, so the council then kind of comes around. They see the Warden's dead, and like immediately they're no longer aggressive towards Theo. And so they go into the shack, and he shows them the child. The state police are there, but everyone's non-aggressive towards Theo now. The council's like really happy there's a baby. There's this, another kind of human moment where they're all just like looking at the baby, and they're like, ooh, a baby. which is kind of
the way that everybody gets at one
point. It's a really weird ending. And then, yeah, so Theo's kind of automatically assumed control. And he says there are evils to be remedied, but they must take their turn. He couldn't do everything at once. There had to be priorities. And then he's like, was that what Zan had found? And it's the kind of like, you know, power corrupting people.
Yep.
And so Julian asks him about the ring, and he says it's useful for the present and how she'll take it off in time. Which is like, yeah, exactly. It's like, it's just really weird. And like, it's kind of preposterous in a way that he's like, I'm going to be the Warden now.
Smeagol steals the ring.
Yeah, which is like, he didn't even really like want that. No. And he didn't seem to care about that at all. So that's really weird in my opinion.
Yep.
So yeah, the novel ends with Theo christening the baby.
Like a dog.
No, like a baby.
Huh. Okay.
I did write down one quote I liked, which is Julian talking about how she cheated on Rolf, and she says, can you understand that? The need to hurt someone because you can no longer love. So that's Children of Man.
Yeah, I did not remember a whole lot of that story.
It's a good book. It's kind of not like what I would usually read, I guess.
Yeah.
It felt different. I mean, for one thing, it's pretty contemporary compared to a lot of the books I read.
Very true.
This book came out like literally like 100 years after Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde came out. So
it's quite the jump for it is. Sure.
Yeah, I would recommend the book. It's good.
We'll have to try and get the movie going next.
I do want to see the movie, which is very different from the book.
I'm glad you like that one because I know that you've been interested in that one for quite a while.
Yeah, so very different than my usual fare. Some fun facts. I was looking at Goodreads, like I mentioned. Goodreads is so stupid. It's unbelievable. Like everything everyone says on Goodreads, that's not fair. A lot of the reviews on Goodreads feel the opposite of how I feel about books. Like I won't like a book and I go on Goodreads just randomly and people will be like, this is such a great book, 4 stars. And then it's like, I like Children of Men. I think it has like a 3.5 or something on Goodreads. But a lot of people were like, not as good as the movie. They're like, this book is boring. This book isn't what it should have been. It could have been better, which is such a stupid criticism.
I mean, to be fair, I've made that criticism before, and I don't feel it's entirely unwarranted, but...
For Twilight?
No. It's, I don't know. I won't specify the book because it's not really fair because they're a local author, and I don't want to, you know...
Yeah.
I respect the hustle.
It I mean, that's kind of different when it's like a local author and like you probably could literally have done it better. P.D. James is like a pretty lauded author.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I kind
of... People talk about Children of Men and they're like, this book will become a classic. Mm-hmm. Like, kind of
but
thing.
But it could have been done better. It's like...
Okay. Well, yeah. And it's just like, I don't know. I think that's kind of unfair. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing when people criticize art.
Yeah.
They're I could have done that better than this. And I'm like, well... probably not realistically. Mm-hmm. It could have been better.
Yeah.
And it's like, or you could accept it for what it is.
Yeah.
It's just a weird thing. I don't think I've ever read a book and been like, could have been better. Like, it just seems like such a strange criticism, you know? Cue me literally saying that sentence later in the podcast.
One day.
But yeah, Goodreads, people are crazy. The things people say on there are just wrong, which is funny. Like, I remember at one point, someone in one of the like reviews said that Zan was gay. That's okay. Not true. That's not, his sexuality is not even mentioned in the book.
No, like
his
hinting
father
or...
is gay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they thought his dad and him were the same person.
Oh.
Or they mixed them up. Another one.
Comprehension.
Theo's ex-wife, you know, she sees, starts seeing someone new that's in the book, and he's an artist who is described as having a build similar to a rugby player. And someone on Goodreads said, like, his wife is banging a rugby player half her age. And I'm like, okay, but she's not, though, because that's not what he is.
So what if she was?
I just, well, it's
that
just
sounds
funny.
So critical, like, but then it's also wrong.
It's just like, where do you, you made that up. It's not true. You took a fact and like switched it into something it's not.
Did the wife divorce him because of the daughter?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of resentment after that. But I think they stayed together for quite a long time afterwards.
Hmm.
Yeah, but they did break up. But yeah, I thought it was really interesting, the whole pre-apocalypse stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might have been my favorite part of the book.
I can see why.
Yeah, that's really compelling in my opinion. There's some like fake religiosity to kind of juxtapose Julian's like moral Christianity kind of thing. Because there's like these like kind of TV preacher people.
Like televangelists kind of?
Yeah, things? Kind of.
Okay.
They're just like talking about God is love and stuff like that. And like one of the things she talks about, I think she's pretty religious, or she was pretty religious, P.D. James.
Okay.
Some of the people said like that it was kind of ham-fisted, the religion in the book. I don't really think that was true. I thought it was relatively subtle. I feel like some of the commentary on power was really immature, though.
Okay.
Like, it's kind of an immature voice to talk about power. Like, the whole, like, Theo's character and the nature of people in general, I think. It's, like, kind of preposterous the way the book ended.
Hmm.
He's like, I'm in charge now.
I'm in charge now, but I'll take the ring off when it's time for me. It's like, no, that's not
usually. Well, I mean, like, I could see that kind of happening, but it just felt really random.
Hmm.
But yeah, I just feel like, you know, if power is the theme of the book, or like how power corrupts, like, it kind of, it touched on it in some ways that were salient, but yeah.
Could have been done better.
Could have been done better. Could have been done better. Zan was gay.
Is that our theme for this episode? It could have been done better.
Oh, we'll have to think of a title. Bane and a rugby player. Thought it was hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just like, you made that up. That's not even in this book.
Goodness. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed your book. We both had to kind of like, well, didn't have to, but we waited quite a while to read these books that we've been looking forward to. I'm glad you enjoyed yours, because I certainly did not enjoy mine.
It was pretty good.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, ooh, before I forget. So we actually have some social media stuff that we've made since the first episode came out. So in case anybody wants to follow us or get in touch in any way, we're on Twitter. At VDB Podcast. And we also have an email account at verydifferentbooks@gmail.com. So yeah, if you have recommendations or things you'd like us to cover, perhaps.
Or if you just want to share your thoughts in also a non-public setting.
If you want to trash us and only have us know about it, that's
Jared,
the way to go.
Your opinions on P.D. James' excellent... Oh, fuck, I forgot the title of the book. The Children of Men are preposterous. You've missed the point entirely.
So that's the place to do it, yeah.
Yeah, at least I don't think Zan's gay. At least I didn't make up facts about the book.
True.
I might have.
Thanks again for listening, and we hope the volume works a little bit better on this one.
Yeah, I think it's going to be better for sure.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to VDB. I've been Jared.
I've been Victoria.
Bye.
Bye.